after Daniel has been taken into captivity, 605 BC to about 539. It's now 539 BC. So Nebuchadnezzar is long gone. Okay, now King Nabonidus is reigning in Babylon. Meanwhile, so first of all, Daniel is much older at this point, okay? Bob points out in the book, even if Daniel had been taken into captivity when he was 16, he's going to be a whole lot older at this point by the time this story takes place in Daniel chapter 5. Meanwhile, while Nabonidus is reigning in Babylon, Cyrus, one of the rulers of Persia, is starting to rise in power. He's starting to advance the Persian Empire, and he's attacking the city of Babylon, approaching the city of Babylon. This very night, ironically, in Daniel chapter 5, is when Cyrus makes his attack on Babylon. So we get into Daniel chapter 5, and we see Belshazzar is now reigning. This is one of the descendants of Nebuchadnezzar. It's not a direct son, but Nabonidus' son, who is one or two generations away from Nebuchadnezzar. So we get into Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar's reigning in Babylon, and he throws this feast for 1,000 of his lords. He gets everybody together, and they're drinking, they're feasting, they're all drunk with wine. And Belshazzar gets the bright idea to bring out the vessels of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple to use them to fill their fill with their wine and get drunk. So he brings out these vessels from the house of the Lord, and they use them for the feast. And while this is going on, they're continuing to get drunk. They're praising their gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. That's the exact wording that Daniel gives in verse 4. So while this is going on, this hand comes out of nowhere and starts writing on the wall. And Belshazzar sees this hand writing. And Belshazzar immediately sobers up. It says in verse 6, and the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. So immediately Belshazzar sobers up when he sees this hand writing on the hand of a man writing on a wall opposite him. And he diligently seeks the interpretation of this writing. And he promises that whoever can interpret this writing will be given third place in the kingdom. So Bob asks this question in the book, why does he promise third place in the kingdom? Is Belshazzar not king at this point? Why third place? Right. Nabonidus is still reigning at this time. He's still alive. Belshazzar is just reigning in Babylon, right? Belshazzar promises that whoever can interpret this writing will be given third place in the kingdom. So he calls all of his astrologers, it says the Chaldeans and the soothsayers, to interpret this message, but they can't do it. Why could they not interpret the message? Yeah, they didn't know, right, what it meant. On the other end, too, it was written in Hebrew form, so no telling if they'd read it or not. But more importantly, though, whether or not they could read it, its message was hidden from them. So all of these astrologers and Chaldean soothsayers, they can't interpret this message for Belshazzar. So the queen comes, and she reminds Belshazzar that there's this man. And she tells him not to be afraid, not to be scared, because there's a man who had the power to interpret dreams, solve riddles, and explain enigmas. Look at verses 11 and 12. She says, there's a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God, In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. So Daniel, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, was made the chief of all of the people that Belshazzar is now calling in to interpret this dream. And she's reminding him of this. Here's this man who was once chief of all of the astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. And he has been given this spirit from God to be able to interpret these things. So she recommends to Belshazzar that they call in Daniel to interpret the writing. So you can imagine, as we pointed out at the beginning of the lesson, a more aged, likely frail Daniel coming in before the king, possibly in his 70s, 80s, coming in before Belshazzar. Belshazzar calls him in. And Belshazzar anticipates Daniel's interpretation of the dream and makes the same promise to Daniel that he had made to his other men, saying, if you can interpret this, I'll make you third place in the kingdom. I'll give you all these riches and glory. Yet Daniel declines the riches, but agrees still to interpret the message. At the beginning of his interpretation of the message, Daniel begins with the rise, or he recounts the rise and fall of Nebuchadnezzar, verses 18 through 21. I want to read this passage, or this part. It's a little bit longer, but so we're only covering two chapters today, so we have the time. Verses 18 through 21, listen to how Daniel begins his interpretation of this message. He says, O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. Because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his spirit was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. So again, Daniel approaching this first from Nebuchadnezzar's pride and Nebuchadnezzar's rise and how he once had all the power to even kill and keep alive. And once his spirit was hardened with pride, he says in verse 20, that's when God decided to bring him down. And he's using Nebuchadnezzar as this example for what he's about to tell him in verses 22 and following. He says, Belshazzar, you knew these things. You knew that this happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Still, you didn't humble your heart. You've been given the same power in a lot of ways, but have not humbled yourself before God. And it says in verse 23, you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. And he says right here, this very night, you've brought in the vessels from the house of God, defiled these things by drinking wine out of them, getting drunk and praising your gods of silver and gold and bronze and wood and iron and stone. And he says, the God who holds your breath and in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. He said that, it says that at the end of verse 23. So Belshazzar, Daniel points out, has not learned the lesson from his forefather, Nebuchadnezzar, of rising up against God and boasting before God, not acknowledging God. And really, you could say the heart of the issue is found in verse 21. what God wanted Nebuchadnezzar and what God wanted Belshazzar to know was that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, that God was the one that was really in control. That's what God wants them to learn. So Daniel then gets into interpreting the actual message that Belshazzar sees on the wall, the writing. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin, or peris is another form of that word. Mene comes from a verb meaning to number. Daniel says that God has numbered your kingdom and brought it to an end. Interpretation of tekel was from a verb meaning to weigh. Again, these are Hebrew forms. It says, you have been weighed upon the scales and have been found lacking. And lastly, peris or upharsin, another form of upharsin, from a verb meaning to divide. It says, your kingdom is separated from you and has been given to the Persians. Which again, this very night, we're going to see this take place. We're going to see this come to fruition. So after Daniel interprets the dream, Belshazzar still fulfills his promise to him. He clothes him with this purple robe, puts a chain of gold around his neck, and he still makes him third place in the kingdom. That this very night, Belshazzar is killed and his kingdom is divided, taken away from him. On page 61 in the book, I brought my book to church, but I don't know where I put it. Bob goes through this, the kind of the background story of this, of how Cyrus has dug this channel from the river, and this channel led straight to the city of Babylon, and how they waded in the water and attacked this gate, and there was nobody. I think that's it. Thanks. There was nobody there guarding the gate. Thank you. And Cyrus acknowledges, praises his own God in the Cyrus Cylinder on page 61, talking about Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, is how he's described, got him into his city, Babylon, without fighting or battle. So again, Cyrus essentially faced no resistance in going into Babylon this very night that this is taking place between Daniel and Belshazzar. And in that very night, Belshazzar is slain. And Darius the Mede is placed in charge of Babylon. So let me get here. So this is not Darius the Great that we'll see later in the Bible story. This is a different Darius. But he is one of the men of Cyrus, and Cyrus places him in charge of Babylon. And thus begins the rule of the Medo-Persian Empire. That second portion of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream in Daniel chapter 2, the chest of silver, this is the beginning of that reign, the Medo-Persian Empire, represented in that chest of silver in that dream. So let's talk a little bit about some lessons for us that we can learn from Daniel chapter 5. First of all, the most obvious lesson in reading through this, I think, is the issue of pride. In verses 21 through 22, we read how Nebuchadnezzar had raised himself up and did not know that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men. In verse 22, Daniel pointed out that Belshazzar was doing the exact same thing, did not humble his heart, he said in verse 22. I think about this, obviously, in regards to us as individuals, we can have pride and not acknowledge God as being in control in our own lives. But maybe in the context of a nation, I think about us maybe as Americans. There's a lot of pride that is associated with American people in the world. And a lot of people don't like Americans. Because of that pride. And you see it all over, I see it all over the internet, people acting as if America is just, you know, in control and is always going to be in control, has all power, all authority. That's kind of the attitude that is taken on by a lot of Americans. I just want to warn us. There's nothing wrong with being thankful and grateful for living in a country where we have freedom. But I want us to be cautious as Americans, as people who do have this freedom, not to be prideful and arrogant as if we have given this to ourselves and won this just for ourselves. It's a gift of God. And we have to understand, like Belshazzar, that the Most High God is the one who rules in the kingdoms of men. It's not President Obama. It's not the American military. It's God. So what we have today in America, the blessings and the freedoms are from God. And we need to, again, acknowledge him for those things. And then, of course, as individuals, we could have an issue with this. But I wanted to point that out as Americans, again, in the context of a nation that we see in Daniel 5. Another lesson we could learn from Daniel 5. Do we understand who is in control of our very breath? He said that in verse 23. He said, "The God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." This really ties closely in with the lesson that I just pointed out in verses 21 through 22. But again, understanding that God is in control of of every moment of our life. God holds every breath in his hand. Again, that's a powerful thought, should be a humbling thought for us. And that's what Daniel intended it to be for Belshazzar, understanding that God is in control of our very breath.
Along that line, just thinking about God and his long suffering, to picture God having our life in his hand, and with all of what we do, and along with our pride, what God can do at each moment, he can snuff us out. He's holding that long suffering. He doesn't want us to perish. He loves us. So. Also, to see that self-restraint
and
long suffering for
us, and the power that we all have. Right. Yeah. Right. Mr. Seod is mentioning how God has that control, and then recognizing that God has restrained multiple times had that self-restraint to not punish us in the times that we were prideful. And the way that we acknowledge that and show thankfulness for that is in humility. And that's a really good point. Just having that constant humility, understanding again, that when we understand that God is in control of every moment, then that should cause us to be humble every moment and acknowledging that. All right. Any other, go ahead, Lorenzo.
God doesn't give you freedom or anything just because he deserves it. God gives him because he's merciful. And just as the CEO, he gave it away because it was part of his plan, not because they deserved it, or because it was special. You know, it was just everyone's plan as he had promised. So it's out of his mercy that you have things, not because you deserve it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's out of God's mercy that we even have freedoms like we have in America today. And in response to that, I would say God gives us freedoms like we have today. And not only to enjoy them, but to use them in service to him. And that's the great thing is, the amazing thing about it is that in response to the mercies that God has extended to us through the freedoms and gifts that we've been given in this life and even spiritually, we ought to be using them out of our humility to help other people and to serve other people. That's the heart that God wants from us, not just a heart that says thank you and uses it all selfishly, but again, you taking those opportunities and using them to help other people and serve him ultimately. All right, good thoughts. Anything else? All right, let's move on from Daniel chapter 5. Let's go into Daniel chapter 6. So we saw at the very end of Daniel 5, Darius the Mede is in power now. And he sets over the kingdom 120 satraps, these rulers. And over these 120 satraps, he sets three governors. And guess who's one of those governors? Daniel. So, interesting thing here. You notice throughout the story of the book of Daniel up until this point, the favor that Daniel has had throughout multiple kings, right? But we see three. He's seen favor in Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar elevated his position. Belshazzar elevated his position. And Darius the Mede elevates his position. So you see how God has been with Daniel throughout all of these three different kings, two entirely different empires, different kingdoms. Still, God is allowing Daniel to find favor, and not only favor, but to have power in two different kingdoms. It's pretty amazing to see how God is carrying Daniel through all of this. Again, it reiterates the point that God is the one that rules in the kingdoms of men. Daniel's service to God is what has given him this power and responsibility in the sight of all of these kings in two different empires. Just an interesting point to note. And we continue to see that, and we'll see that at the end of chapter 6. So Daniel's made one of the three governors over these 120 satraps who are ruling over the kingdom. And it says that Daniel finds favor in the sight of the king, or he distinguished himself above the governors and satraps, it says in verse 3, because he had an excellent spirit in him. So Daniel, again, he's serving with this excellent spirit, this humble spirit, obviously, that we see in Daniel, this devoted spirit to God. And he elevates himself above the other governors and satraps so much so that they're jealous, and they seek to trap Daniel, okay? They want to get Daniel out of power, but they can't find any fault in him because he's such excellent spirit. He has so much integrity, they can't find fault in Daniel. So their only choice is to find fault in Daniel in his obedience to God. That's the only way that they can catch Daniel and get him out of power. So they come to Darius and they ask him to make this decree that anyone who petitions any god or man for 30 days other than Darius will be thrown into the den of lions. So Darius hears this. Sounds good to him. He signs this written decree. And according to Medo-Persian law, anything that is signed or written in law can't be changed. And that was, he says that in verse 12. And we'll get there here in just a second. But it says explicitly that according to the Persian law, that anything that was written down or written in law couldn't be changed. So now Darius is stuck in this position where he signed this decree that no one can petition anyone but him for 30 days or else they'll be thrown into the den of lions. Well, this is great for the men who, these satraps and governors who are trying to catch Daniel, because Daniel, as soon as he hears this decree, he continues to open his window and pray towards Jerusalem, just as he had done from his early days, is what the scriptures say. Let me interject this thought here. Why is it that Daniel is praying towards Jerusalem? Is there a passage that you all can think of that might be tied in closely with Daniel? Daniel's here in captivity and he's opening his windows towards Jerusalem. I'm thinking of 2 Chronicles chapter 6. 2 Chronicles 6 And beginning in verse 28, or it might be 38. I think I typed it wrong in my notes. 2 Chronicles 6, 38. And then let's go through verse 39. So this is the dedication of Solomon's temple. Okay, Solomon's dedicating his temple to God, and he says in verse 38, when they return to you with all their heart, with all their soul, in the land of their captivity, where they have been carried captive, and pray toward their land which you gave to their fathers, the city which you have chosen, and toward the temple which I have built for your name, then hear from heaven your dwelling place, their prayer, and their supplications, and maintain their cause, and forgive your people who have sinned against you. Daniel's really fulfilling 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verse 38, right? Being carried away into captivity, but still turning with all his heart to God and praying towards Jerusalem, praying towards this city, towards that temple that Solomon had dedicated there in 2 Chronicles chapter 6. So Daniel continues to open his window, pray towards Jerusalem three times a day. And these men catch Daniel in the act and report it to Darius. And their plan is going just as perfectly as they had planned.
I don't know if this is significant, but on that verse 10 and that verse 10, you know, he didn't, I don't know about King David, I didn't compare to translations, but I think from here he didn't go in and open the windows. You know, he didn't go in and shut them either. But they were open. He just went ahead and did what he had always done.
Right. I guess you're pointing out maybe he didn't open them just because of the decree. Is that kind of what you're saying? Right. It's just habit. Yeah. Yeah. No fear. Go ahead.
So maybe he also knew that it's kind of like, so he was, trying to God, this is what he promised also in this type of prophecy. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. Daniel, maybe see redemption, return from captivity in sight, and praying praying to God because of that. That's a good point, too.
This says that this was his custom since early days. While the Jews were to pray toward the land and toward Jerusalem and toward the temple, although the temple wasn't standing at this time, Daniel was praying that way. He was doing it three times a day. The three times a day was probably his personal discipline, his custom to do this way. I think there's a big lesson in that for us today, that, when we have personal disciplines that we have about prayer, about Bible reading, about whatever it might be, the laws of men, what's going on in the world around us, really don't have anything to do with that. And don't alter that. It wasn't that God had commanded him that he had to do this way. This was his way of continuing his relationship with God. And as Lorenzo said, he's concerned about his people and the hope for returning to captivity and all that. But my point is, here's a man who, because of his personal devotion to God, none of that is going to be altered by what is going on in the world around him, what people say or do. He's just going to have this relationship with God, come what may. And I think there's a great lesson in that for us.
Right, yeah. Mr. Klein, for those of you who may not have heard, just pointing out how this seems to be Daniel's personal custom, praying three times a day, and how Daniel was going to allow the laws of men, the things of men that didn't influence his dedication, his personal dedication to God and to his relationship with God and to his concern for his people, as he's pointing out. And we will talk a little bit more about that here in just a little bit. But those are all great thoughts. And we can maybe make some a little bit more personal application about that here in a minute if we have some time. So Darius, continuing on with the story, Darius is displeased with himself, it says, with the law. I'm assuming referring to the law that he has now signed because it's condemned, convicted Daniel. So after he labors diligently to the going down of the sun to deliver him, it says in verse 14, he finds no reason to deliver Daniel, no way around this law, and Daniel's thrown into the lion's den. Yet Darius had faith in God that he would deliver Daniel. And we see no indication wavers either in the story. So Darius ends up fasting all night for Daniel. He calls for no entertainment to be brought to him. And early in the morning, he anxiously rushes to the lion's den. And he says, "Has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then verse 22, Daniel responds with a plea of innocence. He says, "My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you." Again, Daniel pleading his innocence. Also note, it is important to note too, and I think Bob pointed this out in the book, that this plea of innocence did not come prior to being thrown into the lion's den. But after. Daniel wasn't pleading innocence to be delivered from the punishment, but it's after God has delivered him. It just shows a little bit of the character of Daniel there. So Darius makes this decree in response to the deliverance. First of all, he has all of these men, these governors and satraps who had tried to catch Daniel, who had him sign this law, thrown into their wives and their children, and it says immediately the lions overpowered them, broke all their bones in pieces before they could ever reach the bottom of the pit. And then Darius makes this decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. And he goes on to say how he's a living God, he's steadfast forever. He is the one whose dominion shall never end. He delivers and rescues. He worked signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Very similar to what we saw from Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3, when after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we see the same kind of response from Darius in making this decree that all people must fear the God of Daniel. And then in verse 28, we see that Daniel continues to prosper in the kingdom. It says in verse 28, it says, Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So again, Daniel continuing to prosper, continuing to find favor in the sight of these kings, these rulers, in separate kingdoms and separate times. And again, you think about that span of time as well. At least 66 years, finding favor in the sight of these rulers. Okay, so let's talk quickly about some lessons for us from Daniel chapter 6. First of all, Daniel, in verse 3, we talked about how he had this excellent spirit within him. And it says this is what distinguished himself above the governors and satraps. Good lesson for us, seeing having this integrity, having the devotion to God that we ought to have, should distinguish us. Not that we do it for that reason, but it should set us apart amongst other people, distinguishing us for, again, for the excellent spirit. And again, when I say excellent spirit, I'm thinking in my mind in spirit of integrity. That was the spirit of Daniel. Also, we talked here about Daniel's habit of prayer. I guess my first thought in reading that was somewhat similar to what Mr. Klein was mentioning, how Daniel had just disciplined himself to do this on a daily basis. It's so important. I remember his name is escaping me now. Buddy, president of Florida College. Buddy Payne, thank you. Man, this shouldn't be happening to me. I'm only 25 years old. When I was at Florida College, he mentioned, and here's a man in his 70s, mentioned in a chapel talk the importance of daily Bible reading and prayer. And I remember thinking when he said that, well, yeah, you know, that's important. But, you know, that was just a few, maybe 5-6 years ago for me. But still, I find that, yes, in knowledge, I understand the importance of that. But actually making that a habit in our lives, that's really important. It's difficult, but it's important. Daniel made this a habit in his life to pray to God 3 times a day. How important should consistent prayer, consistent Bible study be in our own personal lives? What's the priority of that in our life? Are we making that a priority? Are we willing to wake up early and do it? Stay up late and do it, whatever it may be. Again, what kind of sacrifices are we making to make habits of a connection with God through scripture reading, through prayer, and things like that? Daniel's a great example of this in verse 10, because even in the face of opposition, he continued to do that. Go ahead, Mr. Cedar.
David had that same kind of habit.
Right. Mr. Shoda mentioned how David had that same habit of praying 3 times a day. So again, just a great example for us. All right, real quickly, Daniel's faith, mentioned in verse 10, that God would deliver from captivity. Lorenzo kind of mentioned that. Daniel was known for his continual service to God. Darius points that out in verse 16 and 20. He says, "Your God whom you serve continually." Again, another good example for us. This is what Daniel was known for. Verse 23, it says that he was delivered because he believed in his God. Daniel did have faith that God would deliver him. This is kind of, you know, he was left out of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego situation, but Daniel proves himself and his own faith here in chapter 6 with his faith in God and his belief that God would deliver him. And then lastly, in Darius's decree concerning God, he mentions that he delivers and rescues, which really fits in perfectly with the rest of our story. In all of this, God has delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's delivered Daniel, really establishing even more firmly in their minds that he's going to deliver his people and that he can and will. And so really that sets the stage for what's going to come in our future or in the rest of our study, of the fact that God is willing to and capable of delivering and rescuing his people as the story unfolds. All right. Thank you for your attention and for the comments.